Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Show's so nice, we got to do it twice. It's Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, author of books such as The Eucharist is Really Jesus and The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, apologist extraordinaire here at Catholic Answers, and of course, the host and proprietor of the YouTube channel Shameless Popery, which you can find, again, you just go into YouTube or your favorite podcast app, type in Shameless Popery, should be the only result that shows up under that name. And Joe, what is coming up next on Shameless Popery?
Yeah, I've got a sit-down with Braden Cook, where we look at one of the really fascinating, kind of underused arguments during the Reformation, which is an argument made by St. Francis de Sales about the need for authority. You know, St. Paul says, how can men preach unless they're sent? And so Francis de Sales unpacks that, and then we unpack that. What does this mean for the reformers who are neither sent directly by God? They can't show that they've been, you know, they aren't prophets on a mission from God, in other words. And they're not sent by the church to go into schism from the church. And so then the question becomes, on what authority then do they do any of the things that they're trying to do? So that's it in a nutshell. There's a much longer conversation about that coming out in 6 days.
6 days from now. Okay, so watch the space on the YouTube channel for, on Joe's YouTube channel, I should say, for that discussion with our good friend Braden Cook, a previous guest on this program and a host of his own very good YouTube channel, The Catechumen. That should be a great discussion with Joe Heschmeyer. Well, we got lots more people on the phones ready to talk to you, Joe, so let's go over to Raleigh, North Carolina, where Kevin is listening on Divine Mercy Radio. Kevin, you are on the air with Joe. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, good afternoon, Joe. My name's Kevin, as you know, and my question has to do about discernment of the priesthood. At this point in my life, I'm 32, single. When I was growing up, I always imagined I'd have a wife and kids by now, but hasn't played out quite yet. Not done looking, but I'm thinking of ways, how do I use my life to honor God? What does a 32-year-old guy become a priest? What does that even look like? Is it 4 years of a quote-unquote college? Am I going to be older than everybody else? I'm not even like really considering it, but enough to call you. So I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I was something of a later vocation myself. That's the euphemistic parlance they use for people like us. I was
old people. That's their euphemism for old people.
Yeah,
is that
later vocations.
Brutal. They should just come
right
out.
So you know,
say,
it's the guys who aren't coming straight out of high school or college. The track has actually changed slightly. They've added 1 year of propaedeutic year, and that just means basically, the church in America realized that a lot of men entering formation for the priesthood needed time to be free of all of their attachments to the world, the internet and technology and phones and all of this stuff, and to be more deeply formed as Christians and to have just like a simple Christian life where they're not kind of stuck in the chaos and hubbub of modernity. So there's a propaedeutic year. You need a philosophy degree. So guys who haven't had any college will do 4-year college. Guys who've already got a college degree will do 2 years of more intensive focus just on philosophy. This is pre-theology. And then in the U.S., theology then takes 4 years. And so depending on, typically it's like 7 to 9 years. It can be a little longer than that if you have things like language studies for people who English isn't their first language. So it is, it's quite a long process. They don't try to rush it. And I'm actually grateful that it's a long process because I think that the idea is to have priests for life. You could rush through formation and get guys who are half formed and you know, that wouldn't go well. There's a lot of reasons. You want to make sure that the person is well-formed at a human level, that he's well-formed at an intellectual and spiritual level, that he has a good sense of his pastoral calling and all of that. So in terms of your own case, I'd say a few things. Number one, the mere fact that you're unmarried at 32 is no sign that you are certainly called to the priesthood. That said, I mean, I'm not saying that you're not called to the priesthood. There may be other signs that point in that direction. You should really make an active praying for the clarity to find out what it is God wants for you. And it sounds like your heart is already in a very good place of saying, like, you want meaning and purpose and you want to do something for God. To that end, a couple resources, if you are serious, either now or in the future, about taking a closer look at seminary and at priesthood. The book To Save a Thousand Souls by Father Brett Brannan is a good kind of standard issue book. A lot of dioceses will actually give out copies of that book to men who are sort of discerning whether they're called to apply. Two, you want to make sure you've got a good daily habit of prayer. And three, at some point you're going to want to talk to a vocation director. You don't have to wait till you got total clarity, but if you're serious enough that you're saying this is maybe something that I'm being called to by God, where it's more than an idle curiosity, but less than a firm commitment that this is definitely what you're doing, that's the right period to reach out to a vocation director and then just say, here's where I am. And a good vocation director isn't going to try to sell you. A good vocation director is going to want to just find out what's going on in your heart, what's going on in your life. And they're going to try to help you discern whether or not God is calling you in that direction. So there's plenty of ways in the meantime that you can serve God. But if that's something that you think God might be calling you to, those would be some concrete steps I'd take in that direction. Does that help, Kevin?
Yeah. Can I recap? You said you were going to recommend this book and then also talk to a vocational director. Did I miss something?
And right. And just make sure you have a good disciplined regimen of prayer. You know, in seminary, you're going to pray the Liturgy of the Hours. You, the hypothetical you at least, is going to pray the Liturgy of the Hours. So if you get in the habit of trying to do maybe morning prayer, evening prayer, or both, that can be a very good spiritual practice. It's beautiful. Actually, Vatican II recommends the laity pray the Liturgy of the Hours anyway. And so it's a great way to just have the rhythm of prayer in your day. And I think you'll find that you grow tremendously with that, whatever it is God's calling you to.
Kevin, thanks so much for that call, and God bless you as you continue to discern your vocation. That's certainly something worth calling in about, because it's something that we should take seriously. So thank you for that call, Kevin. I want to get to Scott now, listening in Oklahoma City, listening on Oklahoma Catholic Radio. You've been waiting very patiently for over an hour now, Scott, so thank you for hanging on the line there. You are on the air with Joe Heschmeyer. Go ahead with your question, Scott.
Mr. Heschmeyer, how are you doing tonight? Hope you're doing good.
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Oh, great. Really good now. I'm talking to one of my favorite spigots on St. Ephraim's Fountain he talks about. Anyway, I got something I've been thinking about. I've heard people talking about devotion to Mary, worshiping Mary in the rosary. They always bring up repeating prayers, the Jesus is teaching about don't babble in your prayer, stuff like that, but then all of the Hail Marys. But then specifically, I was wondering, and I've heard it touched on, but I've never had a good explanation. Why are there two mysteries devoted to Mary?
In terms of, like in the Glorious Mysteries, you mean?
Yes, the Assumption.
The Assumption and the Coronation.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'll answer both of those. So I don't know if you listened in the first hour. I already addressed part of your question, people who conflate intercessory prayer with worship. So I'm going to focus on the other two parts. Number one, the idea that the rosary is bad because it's repetitive. And number two, the idea the rosary is bad because it involves two mysteries involving Mary. So on number one, as you say, the Greek word in Matthew 6 doesn't actually say repetition. It says babbling. And so this is translated in the KJV as vain repetition. The word is, I believe it's a Hapax legomena. Like it's a unique word, in like it doesn't appear elsewhere. But we know the root of the word is referring to someone who's a stutterer or a stammerer. And so don't just like stammer in your prayers. Don't just stutter. Don't just like babble on in your prayers, like they might in Babylon. And
Joe,
I'm not going to apologize.
Joe,
that was.
I don't expect you to apologize.
You're gonna remember it, though.
I'm still going to reprimand you for that.
You'll remember it, though. Repetitious prayer is only bad if it is mindless. There is nothing wrong with offering the same prayers over and over again. And how do we know this? I'll offer three reasons. Number one, we're given 150 form prayers to pray called the Psalms. Number two, when the disciples ask Jesus to pray, he gives them a form prayer. And if you read the Didache in the first century, Christians were encouraged to pray it at least three times a day. Number three, Jesus himself does repetitive prayer. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he prays the same prayer three times in a row. But it's not a mindless prayer. His whole heart and soul is right there. He is praying his heart out. And, I mean, literally in Matthew 26:44, it says, "So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words." So if saying the same words repeatedly is bad, then they'd better rebuke Jesus. But better yet would just be correct your misunderstanding of what it is Jesus is talking about in Matthew 6. He's not condemning the kind of prayer he models for us. So it is well and good to pray for things over and over again. In fact, I'll add a fourth point. The model of prayer that he offers to us, besides the example he gives us, is the persistent widow. The persistent widow who makes the same request over and over and over again until she gets what she wants. So none of that is consistent with the idea that you're allowed like one time of praying for a certain thing. That's simply not how it is. Luke 18, he tells them this parable to the effect they ought always to pray and not to lose heart. And what is the prayer she's praying repeatedly? Vindicate me against my adversary. And eventually, when she does it enough, he wears out and gives her what she wants. That's not vain repetition. That's an effective repetition. So the rosary is beautiful. It's good. And repeated prayer is great. All right. So the other half then, in the rosary, we are meditating upon these sacred mysteries. And you're right. Principally, these are mysteries from the life of Christ, 18 of the 20 of them, if you include the luminous mysteries. But there are two that relate to things that happened to Mary. One of them is the Assumption of Mary, and the other is the coronation of Mary in heaven. This is a reference to Revelation chapter 12, where John sees a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. So someone is crowned in heaven, and that is a good thing for us to contemplate. And who is this woman? Well, we're told in verse 5 that she brought forth a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Well, who is that? Well, that's Jesus. So the mother of Jesus is crowned in heaven. Now, why would we care about that? Why does John tell us about that? Well, he tells us the answer to that. In Revelation 12, verse 17, after spending the chapter talking about how the dragon is at war with the woman, you may remember Genesis 3:15, where the devil is described as being at enmity, conflict, strife, war with a woman. And that woman, we don't know who it is on the surface. Well, John's revealed it to us. That woman is the mother of Jesus. And so verse 17 says, "Then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus." So it's actually important that we know as Christians that we have a mother who is in heaven. If we're her offspring, she's our mother. And we know where she is. She's in heaven. And we know a little bit about her. She's the mother of Jesus, and she's crowned in heaven. So your mother and mine, if we keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus, your mother and mine is the queen of heaven. And that's a good thing for us to know, particularly if the spiritual battle we're engaged in, described in Genesis and Revelation and plenty of places in between, is between the devil and this woman. In Genesis 3:15, we're told about the seed of the woman. The reason it's the seed of the woman rather than the seed of the man, as you would normally say, is because it's a virgin who's giving birth to the Savior of the world. So Genesis 3, it was important to include Mary. Revelation 12, it's important to include Mary. In Luke 1, Mary says, all generations will call me blessed. So very clearly, an important part of Christian spirituality is meant to be the honoring of Mary in some form. Because she is our mother, and because she's already been honored by God beyond anything we could ever give her. You'll never give Mary any honor that surpasses God making her the Queen of Heaven. Because that's what it is to say she's crowned in heaven in this way.
Scott, thank you
so
much.
What do you think of that?
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Scott. What do you think of that?
Oh, beautiful. I don't have to cancel my podcast subscription. So great job.
Glory.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Best feedback we could get is that you're going to keep giving Joe more money. Love to hear that. Thank you, Scott. That brings us to our next.
Anybody else who wants to do it?
Anybody else? Any other callers, let us know. And yeah, anyone listening, shamelessjoe.com is where you can contribute.
We usually give you books if you want to just give me money randomly.
That's right. Every now and then if something came back, you know. Shamelessjoe.com is where you can support Joe's efforts at Shameless Popery. As I said, that is going to take us to our next break. We'll be right back to answer more questions right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from the Graduate School of Theology at Christendom College. Deepen your understanding of the Catholic faith through live online graduate courses taught with uncompromising fidelity to the Church's magisterium, from Christology and bioethics to Mariology and more. This summer, you can also attend the Institute for Liturgical Formation on campus. Begin your master's degree or earn a certificate at graduatetheology.com. That's graduatetheology.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with a gospel message. EWTN is everywhere, on social media platforms including Audible, iHeart, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and X. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer's here. He is taking your questions about anything you'd like to know about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884 is the number to call when lines are open, which they are not. Everybody wants to talk to Joe, including a caller who's just going by LW, calling us from Georgia. Thank you for waiting. What is your question for Joe Heschmeyer?
Hey, guys. Glad to say I called the show about a month ago, and me and my wife are now Catholic.
Hey!
Super excited.
Congratulations. Praise God.
Welcome home.
Yes, actually, it's a big thanks to you, Joe, and a lot of the videos you've made. Some of my family is excited. Other people are not. But one of the questions that keeps coming up is purgatory. And the idea of it generally makes sense to me about it being purged from the sin and being perfectly in union with God. But the understanding that I had before, and a lot of my Calvinist counterparts, they have the idea that it's just, okay, as soon as you die, it's just instant. It's a pretty legal understanding of just, okay, you die, boom, all the sin goes to Jesus because of the sacrifice, and you go straight to heaven. So my question is, how do I kind of explain how this perfect unification happens and why it's not just instant as soon as you die?
Yeah, I would just connect it to sanctification. Like, we all agree, Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox, God could sanctify all of us instantly, right? He doesn't have to work at our speed, and he doesn't have to allow us to kind of suffer along, two steps forward, one steps back. And you have these cases where there really does seem to be a miraculous transformation. You know, you've got somebody who, let's say they're struggling with addiction, and it's the kind of thing that can be really hell to get out of. But sometimes God simply cleanses them and purifies them and strengthens them and sanctifies them in this supernatural kind of way. And so there's nothing wrong with God doing it instantaneously. There is a lot wrong with demanding that God do it instantaneously. Because we know that even though he can and does do that kind of thing, it's not the norm. It's not the default. And he's never told us that it will be. So I know there are Protestants who will try to find some strained interpretation, you know, at the twinkling of an eye, taken completely out of context. They'll say, when we die, that's the twinkling of an eye. It's like, that's not what the verse is saying. So God can do that. When we get plenary indulgences for other people, or even when we get a plenary indulgence for ourselves, it's because we firmly believe that God can do this instantaneously. But we also believe that given everything we know, this is not the normal way he does things. And it's not the way the Bible describes the normal way. So 1 Corinthians 3, you probably know this passage already. St. Paul talks about how no other foundation can anyone lay than that which has been laid, which is Jesus Christ. And he's going to talk about two groups of Christians, those who already have the foundation of Jesus. He says, now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, that's going to be group one. Then he says, wood, hay, stubble, that's going to be group two. Each man's work will become manifest. For the day, it's going to be judgment day, will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire. And the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work which any man has built on the foundation survives, it's group one, he will receive a reward. Because gold, silver, precious stones, when you put them through fire, they get more beautiful. But then he says, if any man's work is burned up, because wood, hay, and stubble just get incinerated in the fire, they burn up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So there is this fiery purgation. And so it certainly looks like a process of being refined in fire. And this matches Isaiah 6, where Isaiah's lips are purified by the touching of a burning coal from the altar in heaven to purify his lips to preach the word of God. So could that happen instantaneously? Absolutely. Does it happen instantaneously just automatically? No. And so we pray for God to do it instantaneously. We pray for the purification that we need to stand before God. But we don't presume upon it in a way where we just say, oh, I'm sure God will just do it for me. In the same way that if you're struggling against sin, you know, on the one hand, God could heal me of this struggle, this temptation, whatever. But you don't presume on that and just say, I bet he will. So I'm not going to take any steps to rid my attachment to sin. That would be folly. So that's we hold both of those things in hand. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
Awesome. Thank you for that call, LW.
Welcome home again. That's super exciting. If you want to stay on the line and get a book, consider it a little welcome home present.
Yeah, just stay on the line, LW. Just ask for any book that we have in our Catholic Answers catalog and our call screener. We'll send that right along to you. Let's go now to Michael calling from Long Island, New York. Michael, welcome to the show. Go ahead with your question for Joe. Michael, do we have... Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. Sorry, one second. I put the wrong line on air. Michael, we have you now. That was my bad. Go ahead.
It's like Sly's still with us.
Hi, sorry.
Jeff.
It's all good. I just had a question regarding the obligation for almsgiving, specifically for giving to the poor. I was just wondering what circumstances, because I've been doing some searching online, and I've been getting kind of mixed responses for this. So my question is, like, should we always give to people that we see on the streets, like panhandlers or just the homeless? So just to give you an example, there was one situation where I was in, because I usually take public transportation. And I noticed that at one of the bus stops that my bus was going by, that there was a homeless man at the bus. And I'm starting to wondering, okay, should I get off the bus and give this guy something and then wait for the next bus? Or what would be my obligation in that situation? Or, you know, am I just being overly scrupulous about this? And what advice can you give that where someone could be more prudent regarding this?
Oh, sorry about that, Michael.
That's a great question. That was the end of the question, right?
Yeah, that was the end of the question.
Okay, just wanted to make sure you hadn't gotten cut off. Okay, there's a couple principles to know. First, when we're talking about the thou shalt nots, these are what are called the negative precepts. These are absolutes. when God tells you not to do something, you just never do it. Like, don't murder. You don't have to spend any time discerning, well, should I murder this guy? Because they bind absolutely. In the words of St. John Paul II, the negative precepts of the natural law are universally valid. They oblige each and every individual always and in every circumstance. It is a matter of prohibitions which forbid a given action semper et pro semper, always and forever, without exception, because the choice of this kind of behavior is in no case compatible with the goodness of the will of the acting person. He goes on from there. So the negative commandments always bind absolutely. The positive commandments don't do that. God has set a very firm floor, but there is no ceiling. So when he tells us to love him, to love our neighbors, to worship him, to give money to the poor, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, and so on, there's prudence and discernment that's called for. And I'm going to give more kind of concrete details about that after we come back from this break. How does that sound?
Yeah, Michael, just hang on the line real quick, and we'll be back right after this mid-hour break. Got to take this break right now. We'll be right back to finish that answer right after this.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the Church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the Church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm your fill-in host, Thomas Graff, stepping away from my social media duties here at Catholic Answers to take us through this Ask Me Anything show with our staff apologist, Joe Heschmeyer. Joe, we were in the middle of an answer to Michael in Long Island, who wants to know some general guidance for giving to the poor who are living on our streets, to homeless folks. And so you gave a couple principles, but go ahead and finish your answer, Joe.
Yeah, so the first principle I gave is that when we're talking about the commands of God, there's a clear distinction between the negative commandments, the thou shalt nots, and the positive commandments, which tell us what to do. The commandments telling us what not to do bind universally, bind everyone, bind in all situations. It doesn't matter who you are. You should never steal. You should never murder. You should never covet. You should never commit adultery, and so on. But the other commandments, the ones telling you what to do, are much more context specific. So, for instance, honor your father and mother, give to the poor, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the imprisoned. It's literally impossible for you to fulfill those commandments to everyone. There are more hungry people than you have hours in the day or money in your pocket. And so there is a virtue, the virtue of prudence, that's involved in determining when and how to fulfill these commands. The answer is not going to be never, but the answer is going to be very much dependent on circumstances. The Didache in the first century has a fascinating line about this, where it just says to let your alms sweat in your hand until you know to whom you should give. Meaning that there's something to giving prudently and deliberately, where you're not just trying to get rid of the money as fast as you can to check this box, but you're actually being very intentional about it. This is an actual greater act of love, because you're giving your money with a great intentionality to someone who you've decided, this is who God wants me to support. This is who God wants me to give to. St. John Paul II in Veritatis Splendor, in talking about that distinction I mentioned a moment ago between the negative commands and the positive ones, says that the fact that the negative ones are universal and the positive ones aren't universal, don't take from that that the negative ones are more important than the positive ones. Sometimes Christians become so worried that they're going to do something wrong that they don't do anything at all. And that's not actually acceptable. In the separation of the sheep and the goats, what the goats are sent to hell for isn't bad stuff that they did. It's for all the good they failed to do. And so sins of omission are still sins. But we should be very careful with just acting as if every time you don't give to a homeless person or a panhandler that you've automatically committed a sin, because that's not true. John Paul II says, the reason is this: the commandment of love of God and neighbor does not have in its dynamic any higher limit, but it does have a lower limit beneath which the commandment is broken. So there is a floor to how little you can love God and neighbor. And if you go below that floor, you're sinning. And you want to go above that. But you want to go as far above that as you realistically can. And so he says, furthermore, what must be done in any given situation depends on the circumstances, not all of which can be foreseen. On the other hand, there are kinds of behavior which can never in any situation be a proper response. So there's some things that you already know ahead of time. Well, this is definitely not the right way to act. But the particulars of what to do positively are really dependent on the context. So there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all where it's, they say if you ask like three times, then someone's going to give you money. It's not that. Or, I only give to people on Wednesdays. Not that. You have to be in communication with God and with a real discernment for how do you want me to serve you right now? Is it giving money to that guy, or is it buying him a sandwich? Is it giving him a smile? Is there someone else I should be serving? Is there another way I should be serving? Maybe it's not monetary at all right now. That if you have that disposition, that orientation of heart where you're practicing the presence of God, you're being mindful of God, and then you're trying to serve him and open to how he might be inviting you, then you just discern the particular cases as you kind of come across them. And so the final thing I'd say, in using this gift of prudence, it is perfectly appropriate to ask questions like, is this person going to be truly helped by me giving them money? Because you may find situations where a person's in a cycle of, self-destructive behavior and addiction and everything else, and they're refusing the help that's available. And if you give them cash, it's going to only make their life worse. In those situations, you might discern, I think you should discern, that it's prudent not to give. So you're not sinning simply because you don't give money. It would be impossible to say yes every time. You should let the alms grow sweaty in your hands as you try to discern how best to serve God in this context. Does that make sense, Michael?
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm guessing in my particular situation, like the one that I outlined earlier, I guess in that case, I shouldn't worry too much about it since I was, I guess.
You are in New York, right, Michael?
In New York, yes.
Yeah, you are not going to be able to give money to every person who asks for money in New York.
I mean, in this particular situation, it wasn't the person who was asking me. It was someone who was not on the bus. I was on the bus, the bus happened to be passing by, and
oh, I see.
I guess in this particular case, it was, should I have gotten off just to give the person and then wait for another bus, or, it sounds like you're saying that I shouldn't worry too much about that. Is that right?
No, you shouldn't, especially, I don't know how much, you mentioned scrupulosity earlier. If you're somebody who struggles with scrupulosity, then you should take err on the side of seeming to be too lax in your own estimation, because your default is to be too rigid. Other people, that would be bad advice for. Other people have to be reminded to do more. But if you struggle with scruples, that nagging voice in your head, just learn to ignore it on a question like this. And if you have to do something like keep track of the last time you gave so that you can't convict yourself of a fake sin, then do that. But for people who don't struggle with scruples, if you feel this strong desire to go and help a person that you see on the street, I often take that as a circumstance that needs to be attended to, because that could well be Christ in the disguise of the poor. That could well be the person God has placed in my life. And so that kind of thing by itself, if I just feel that draw, I will try to listen to that. But I don't think it's sinful. Certainly it's not automatically sinful not to listen to that. If you're given in other ways, and especially if you're getting in your own head saying, well, am I just overanalyzing this? It's fine to just say, I don't know what to make of that. Lord, I pray for that person. And then you offer the spiritual goods that you're able to offer.
Michael, I hope that was a helpful answer to your question. God bless you as you figure that out. As Joe said, that's a lot of poor people in New York, and you do need some discernment to know how you can best serve those around you in a city like that. It is Ask Me Anything here. The number to call with that open line is 888-318-7884. Mark is calling from Severna Park, Maryland. Mark, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer. You're on the air.
Hi, Joe Heschmeyer. This is the time I'm calling in.
Mark, you are super choppy right now.
Yeah, you're cutting in and out, Mark.
Are you calling from the bottom of a well?
Mark, do we have you there? It's Mark.
And also maybe wonder about what you're...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mark. We got a really rough connection right now. We'll go on to a different caller. Maybe you can... Maybe we'll ask our call screener if he can check back in with you and maybe get a better connection. But that connection isn't going to work for us at the moment. But hopefully we get back to you, Mark. John in Chino, California. Let's go over to John in Chino, listening to us on YouTube. John, you are on the air here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, how are you guys doing today? My question.
Great, John. Yeah, that's a great question to ask, by the way.
My real question is, it's going based off something I read in Vatican II. So one of my friends is trying to be Orthodox, right? So I've been trying to turn him, he's a Protestant, but he's trying to convert. And basically I've been trying to convince him to be Catholic. But the one thing that's kind of holding him back and me back on my theology is that the fact in Vatican II, it says that the Muslims and the Jews pray to the same Abrahamic, monotheistic God. And I don't really understand that. Just because of the fact that they both apostatized from Christ being God,
Yeah. So because you put this in the context of a friend discerning Eastern Orthodoxy, Trent Horn has a good video called "Do Christians and Muslims Worship the Same God?" And he puts my take. He points out that the Russian Orthodox actually say yes to that. Russian Orthodox online, or Orthodox online, will say no. But if you listen to what the patriarchs actually say, they very clearly say yes. This includes the Russian patriarch, Patriarch of Constantinople, and a lot of other leaders in Orthodoxy. So there is actually a big split between what the leadership of the Orthodox Church teaches and what the loudest kind of online Orthodox laity teach. They're just not the same thing. That's the first point. So this isn't a reason to be Orthodox instead of Catholic. And this isn't an issue where the Catholic Church is teaching anything dogmatically. So if you end up in a spot where you're uncomfortable affirming this, that isn't by itself a reason not to be Catholic. You can think that there's a prudential judgment there, that they're misreading the situation of what Muslims believe, et cetera, and that's fine. Nothing hangs in the balance. Having said that, it seems to me very clear that Muslims and Jews do worship the same God as Christians, and that Jesus teaches this. He even describes a Samaritan woman as worshiping the same God. He says in John 4:22, you worship, and he's saying this to the Samaritan woman, remember, you worship what you do not know, We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. Now, the ordinary Jewish layperson, and certainly the ordinary Samaritan layperson, didn't know about the Trinity. And so if to worship the true God, you have to know about the Trinity, then this doesn't make any sense. And moreover, St. Paul, when he's on Mars Hill and he talks about the temple or the altar to the unknown God, he says, "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." So he describes even these people who appear to us to be pagans as worshiping the same God. And he says in Romans 1 about the pagans themselves that they are in guilt because although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. So he says this because he says, what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So he's very clear that these pagans know God, like the one real God, and they just shut off this knowledge. They've allowed their minds to be darkened. Now, he's not claiming that they've all been taught the doctrine of the Trinity. So clearly, everyone saying you have to know about the Trinity to worship the one God, that's false. So that's just the foundational kind of biblical evidence. Two things to note here. One, saying that Muslims worship the same God does not mean that this worship is satisfactory or pleasing to God, or that it's as good as Christian worship, or that there's no need to evangelize or anything like that at all. Those are false conclusions. It's possible to offer bad acts of worship to the true God. I mentioned earlier in the show Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 10, who are struck dead for offering bad worship to the true God. But they're offering it to the true God. This is a low bar to meet, in other words. And so don't take this as saying more than it actually is taking it. The documents of Vatican II, the church has never taught Muslim worship is good enough, so cool. No, that's not it at all. Like, we believe Muslims should convert to Christianity and that their worship is deficient. That doesn't mean that their worship is offered to a false God. It's offered to a bad understanding of the real God. So here's how I would explain that. In philosophy, this is what's called a referent. If you and I are talking about Thomas Graf and you think he's got spiky blonde hair and I think he's got shaggy brown hair, we disagree about a property of him. But we're both referring to the same guy. You might get a lot of stuff wrong and still be referring to the same person I am. There is a philosopher who uses a very good example of this. Like, you go to a Columbus Day parade and you ask somebody what it's about. And they tell you, oh, we're honoring Christopher Columbus. He's the first guy to realize that the world was round. And he's the first European to make it to the New World. Now, if you know anything about history, you might know both of those facts are wrong. Columbus was by no means the first person to believe the world was round or to make it to the New World. But those are popular, incorrect beliefs about Columbus. So this person, everything they've told you about Christopher Columbus, besides his name, is wrong. And yet they're still honoring Christopher Columbus in Columbus Day. And so you can honor the true God, particularly honoring him badly, while knowing very little about him. That doesn't mean good enough, but it does mean that if you go from they got the properties of God wrong to therefore they're worshiping a different God, that is intellectually unsupportable. Like, that's simply wrong. I don't know. What would you say to that? I know I sort of threw a lot at you, John.
No, I mean, I understand, I definitely understand the thought process behind that, right? I did a lot of research on it before, prior to actually calling. I don't know if it was your video or another video, but I read something. It's kind of the same concept. Like, we could tell them that this painting's red, but they're going to say it's green, but no matter what, it's still going to be red, kind of thing, just to where they're praying to the same monotheistic God. It's just the fact that they don't understand it, right? For me, the one thing I just didn't really understand was, if you go back to, I like reading in the Church Fathers. I'm getting into that, right? You go to the teachings of Arius, mm-hmm. is the fact that Jesus was a created being, or he's not divinely inspired, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of just the thing that I can't really wrap my head around, because especially with the Jews, they completely apostatize from Christ. They deny him, even being divine or a prophet or anything. I just don't understand how they kind of worship the same God. I know it's Abrahamic, God, And that part to me makes sense. I just don't understand. Because, you know, and then in scripture it says too, like, that no one can come to the Father, like, without coming through me. That's what Jesus says. So that's kind of just the one thing I had, like, trouble wrapping my mind around.
Well, even so, even in the Arian controversy that you mentioned, there was a general recognition by Nicene Christians, like, that is to say true Christians, that they were worshiping the same Jesus. But one of the points, I believe it was Athanasius made, is that it would be an act of idolatry if they worshipped Jesus while believing him to be merely a creature. But he doesn't think it's like a different Jesus. It's obviously the same person. And even though, like, the question of are they Christian is different than the question of are they worshiping the true God when they are making acts of worship. Like, it is a lower bar to worship God than it is to be a Christian. Because pagans are offering worship in ignorance to the true God in Acts 17. That doesn't mean that they're automatically Christians. And that's very clearly the biblical principle that we have to work with, that you can get a lot of stuff wrong, including the Trinity, and still be oriented towards the true God and still be offering him something. Maybe it's not much. Maybe it doesn't satisfy him. Maybe he rejects it. But the, like I keep saying, like, the bar is just pretty low. So I would say don't let it be a stumbling block. It's not the kind of thing that is dogmatically held, but I think the church is very clearly right and very clearly in keeping with the biblical evidence when it talks about anyone trying to worship the God of Abraham. They're orienting that towards the God of Abraham, even if they're doing it with grave misunderstandings about the Trinity, grave misunderstandings about the nature of God. And those grave misunderstandings may make it so we can't call them brother Christians, but that's a different question entirely.
John, thanks for that question. We got to go to our last break here, but please feel free to call in anytime if you want to continue that discussion. As I said, it's our last break of the hour. We'll be right back to finish it off right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, finishing off a Thursday, sorry, not a Thursday, Wednesday edition of Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. We got a lot of people still on the phone, so we'll try to get through them as quickly as we can. Mark, we're back, going back to you in Severna Park, Maryland. Our call screener tells us we think we have a better connection with you here. Mark, do we have you loud and clear?
Yeah.
Yes.
I can hear you.
Yes, we got you. That's much better, Mark.
Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear this time.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay. That's good. So to recap what I was saying is that recently I just got around to watching your debate with Doug Wilson, and I thought you did a very good job there. And it also made me wonder at the same time, because I have a lot of, think of, strong opinions about Doug Wilson as well. And it made me wonder that whenever someone like you or any other Catholic apologist is engaging another figure, especially one who's very controversial, that how do you find the right balance between, like, when's the right time to be, I think, charitable and inviting versus being much more, like, firm, like, in terms of, like, of either calling out or correcting things that are either heretical or harmful and so on?
That's a good question. In a debate, it's a little bit more structured, and so those questions are actually a little easier to answer. it's harder to answer in ordinary life. In a debate, if your opponent says something that you think is relevant to the debate, or you think it's going to risk misleading and scandalizing the audience. So when people say false things about what the Catholic Church teaches, I will often try to at least nod towards the fact that that's not the actual Catholic teaching. And I might not be able to go into what the Catholic teaching is with the, you know, time limitations, but I can at least say, like, hey, that's not it. That's not what we believe. And hopefully people will at least realize they're, okay, this is not just a given. Because sometimes if you don't say anything in a context like that, people will be like, well, you both agree that the Catholic Church teaches this thing the Catholic Church doesn't teach, but that you didn't have time to correct. So there, I will try to at least make a point of that. I will spend more time on it the more pertinent it is to the debate. There are some debaters where if they're losing or if they're simply debating a Catholic, they just throw out every anti-Catholic tool they have in the toolbox, regardless of what the topic actually is. And so there you just sort of say, like, look, the reason James or whatever the guy's name might be hypothetically is bringing up all this stuff is because he doesn't have an answer for the question before us. And so just kind of recognizing that there's an old principle in law. If the facts are on your side, argue the facts. If the law is on your side, argue the law. If neither's on your side, pound the table. So call it out when people are pounding the table and it doesn't seem like a good faith thing. But if it's pertinent to the debate where they just have misunderstood the Catholic side of a resolution, then you have to spend more time unpacking why it's wrong and setting the record straight just to have a productive conversation. Now, let's apply that in ordinary life. If you're talking to somebody and maybe they're sharing a story with you, they're not debating you, they're just telling you about something. And along the way, they mention something that suggests that they have a false understanding of some dogma. They say, oh yeah, I mean, I know you guys worship Mary and we don't, but you guys are really great people, you know, something like that. I think the bigger the error is, the more incumbent upon you it is to gently correct them. But that can be very difficult depending on the circumstances, and particularly if they're not trying to be combative. If they're trying to be combative, you have a lot more leverage and room to push back, because if they're starting something, they can hardly complain about you defending yourself. The situations where it becomes uncomfortable is when someone's trying to be nice and they get things wrong, or a situation where a child is telling you something and they have some true point and then there's some heresies mixed in there and you don't want to discourage them. So in those cases, it might be okay simply to pass over the things that they're getting wrong if it's not pertinent to what they're trying to say and draw out and focus on the thing that they're getting right. But those situations take a lot of prudence and discernment to do well. Does that make sense, Mark?
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Love the one-word affirmative of that makes sense. That means Joe knocked it out of the park right there. Let's go on to Jeremy calling from Virginia on YouTube. Jeremy, we are very close to the end of the show here, so if you could be very quick with your question, that would be great so we could get you a good answer.
Yeah, I will, Tom. Hey, Joe. Real quickly, I was speaking with Mr. Atheist, and he said that Jesus didn't make any kind of a sacrifice because he knew he would come back from the dead. And I'm hoping maybe you can tell me how I should respond to that.
Okay, that's absurd. I mean, by that standard, because we believe in the resurrection of the dead, no Christian has ever made a sacrifice. The martyrs, nobody. Jesus was voluntarily tortured and slowly executed. The fact that he rose again is literally immaterial to the fact that he really did die. And so he underwent all of the agonies of being tortured and killed. You might as well say, well, to an atheist, well, you're not making a sacrifice because when you die, you think you're just going to go into non-existence. So it's no sacrifice for you either. It simply is an incoherent and unintelligent sort of objection. I know those are strong words, but we're coming right up to the end of the hour, so I got to just say it very bluntly.
There's the kind of heresy that you got to smack down is something that's as poorly formulated and thought out as that. Thank you for that question, Jeremy, for wrapping up the show with us. Thanks to everyone who called, and apologies to those we didn't have time to get to. Please do call back. at any time. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for 2 great hours answering all our callers.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have Joe on. Tomorrow, we're going to have Tim Staples on first hour and then Trent Horn on in our second hour. I believe Edgar will be hosting that show for you instead of me. So thank you all for hanging with me for these 2 hours. It's been a great pleasure to be with you. We'll see you right back here, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.